K-P-O-O, Portland.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
Spark Plug. Stunning. New sounds every other Wednesday 3 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. Join us and get connected.
K-Boo.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, as thousands of government officials, oil and gas representatives, and climate justice activists gather in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for the COP27 conference, Andrea Nika Morris, chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance, will explain what's at stake. Then we'll turn to journalist and author John Nichols for his analysis of the 2022 midterm election results and what they mean for the next 2 years. Finally, as nearly 50,000 UC academic researchers and graduate students commence a historic strike for better working conditions, we'll turn to UC San Diego postdoc Joyce Chan for an explanation. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Thousands of government officials, corporate executives, public relations experts, and climate activists have convened in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for the United Nations' 27th Conference of Parties to tackle climate change. The annual gathering, meant to yield concrete progress on phasing out fossil fuels and ushering in a just transition to renewables, has ended in gridlock more often than not. This year, for the first time, oil and gas companies were invited to officially send representatives to the COP. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden addressed COP27 attendees and apologized for his predecessor's decision to pull out of the Paris Accords, which were signed at COP21. We turn now to Andrea Nika Morris, President and Chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
So as you're watching the proceedings in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, are you feeling what I think a lot of folks are feeling is, here we go again, we're going to get a lot of hype, a lot of talk, and probably, very, very likely, not much else, not much progress?
Well, we have a little bit more hope here in Louisiana because there's activity on the ground here in Louisiana that we certainly hope will complement any investments being made already by the Biden-Harris administration in the form of the investing in the IIJA, the infrastructure bill, and then the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as the ARPA dollars that have already been put out there. There's already funds that can be addressed. There's going to be some Department of Energy grants that can be made available, because we believe that starting with making homes net zero is a great first start to talk about addressing climate change. We need to be investing in people in frontline communities in the global South who are struggling with everyday issues, and that climate is a part of that. Climate intensified hurricanes and wildfires and other issues are making their lives, their everyday lives, just a little bit more hard. And so investing in those issues, finding that intersection between climate and other issues like housing is the best first step. And investing in people, making sure that they understand their voices and accountability. So while there is cause for skepticism at what's going to come out of the COP and what we're going to see moving forward, there's hope still. There's an opportunity for the people to make the right change, to make the right pivot, and to demand that those promises are not false promises, that it's not simply hype.
Now, President Biden has, in response to criticism that gas prices were too high, released gas reserves. He's called for basically flooding the oil and gas market in order to bring down prices. But that's the opposite of what climate justice activists like yourself are calling for, right?
Right. I mean, fossil fuels are a limited resource, and continuing to rely on them is a losing strategy. We know that in the long run. But again, looking at the everyday needs of people across the global South and whether or not they can pay their bills today, whether or not they can get to work today, doesn't make them climate change activists, doesn't make them understand these issues in the long run. And so we've got to find that delicate balance. We've got to be pivoting to renewables. We've got to be talking about making the investments that allow for the smart strategic decisions to move away from fossil fuels. But we can't ignore the everyday needs of people in pursuit of climate change strategy. That's a losing strategy. We've seen that play out. High-minded ideals that don't recognize the needs of everyday people on the ground don't land, right? And we need to have hard conversations. We need to know how to talk to people and get them to understand that some of the decisions that they're making is actually making their circumstances worse, right? But they need real options. We can't just offer people platitudes. We can't just offer people scarcity measures and that they should suffer when they're already suffering. So that is the delicate balance. And again, we've got to teach our leaders how to also walk that delicate balance themselves, not simply do things that might seem popular, but also do things that are strategic and impactful in the long run. We want to build resilient communities, not just relying on people in the global South to themselves be resilient and take blow after blow after blow.
Now, India's representatives at COP27 have called for a phase down of fossil fuels, saying that this is in line with the COP21 Paris Accords that were signed, 6 years ago, that the U.S. had been party to and then pulled out of under the Trump administration and has now rejoined. And yet at this COP27, oil and gas executives were invited officially for the first time. And of course, not only have the number of delegates from that industry gone up, the number of lobbyists have gone up. In fact, there was one report that there were more representatives of the oil and gas industry at COP21 in Egypt than climate justice activists. What do you make of that?
Well, and that's troubling and challenging, but I do know that more people from places like Louisiana who are climate justice warriors who don't just necessarily do that, right? We had partners there who work on things like election engagement. We have partners who work on the front lines around culture, cultural economy, and the rights of the rights of Native New Orleanians and Indigenous people who had never been there before. So while there was an unfortunate increase in oil and gas executives and their lobbyists, there was also a significant increase in new people to this fight, people who live with the consequences of that. And we've got to make sure that their voices are being heard. We've got to make sure that they're getting the messages, they're getting the information from the COP conference and bringing it back to their communities, educating and helping those community members activate and put in place investments, put in place elected officials who will actually honor the strategies that are necessary to move this agenda forward. We don't have a lot of choices other than to deal with the circumstances on the ground, the circumstances as they exist today and tomorrow. But we can be strategic about it. And we also have to recognize when there are people who unfortunately are going to be organizing against the will of the people, against the needs of this planet, we've got to identify them. I, for one, would rather see people face to face rather than being off scurrying behind closed doors, doing God knows what to undermine this agenda. It's easier to fight in the plain light of day.
Now, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network International just released a few weeks ago a report on the gendered and racial impacts of the fossil fuel industry in North America and complicit financial institutions. I know that you've endorsed this report. What are some of the highlights that we need to pay attention to as we're watching the proceedings at COP27 unfold? Because the climate crisis affects some people disproportionately based on their demographics, right?
Right, like so many issues that are facing us in the United States, too many of these issues are colored by race and gender. There are threats. This is a crisis for the entire planet, obviously. But unfortunately, people who are victimized by systemic barriers, by systemic biases, suffer more. And again, we see this with the intersection around climate intensified hurricanes, wildfires, other risks, even the pandemics. These things all hit the most vulnerable even more so. And nowhere do you see that more than in the needs for Black women and their children in housing in places where climate intensified storms affect, where they're dealing with record heat or record cold, where they're dealing with substandard housing to begin with. And they feel these crises first. The resulting insurance spikes and mortgage increases also hit them first. And so this report confirms what we already know, that these issues do not affect people equitably. And so this is why it's important to educate and engage and activate those folks on the ground so that they can turn and fight on behalf of their communities with their elected officials and even against their elected officials to make sure that we have a strategy to address climate change that centers their needs, not simply notions and ideas that don't actually help their everyday lives, much less make sure that their children can be here or that their communities that they've cherished for generations will still be here.
Now, one of the issues that a lot of climate justice activists internationally have raised is that not everybody is equally responsible for creating the crisis in the first place. This has been a huge sticking point for years at the UN COPs, which is that the rich countries should be paying for the damage they've done. Then again, there's all sorts of complications because the governments of the poor countries too are often, you know, hosts to inequality. And so then you've got citizens of those poor nations at the COP to hold their governments and rich governments accountable. There's a lot of dynamics in play, but the overarching frame tends to be the fact that we live in a very, very unequal world where government elites and corporations are at the top and the majority of the people are at the bottom. But that framing gets lost. It becomes a sort of rich countries, poor countries, but it really is rich people, poor people, right? Or rich institutions.
Well,
poor
and people. It's nuanced also as well, right? That we can't step away from the complexity. We cannot abandon that. We cannot, and we also, this is how systemic biases works, right? You recognize that there's an inequity, and then because it's going to be complicated, There's a worry, and then there's also a notion of fair and unfair that has nothing has to do with quantifiable data. It has to do with how people who have privilege feel. And we've got to stop doing that. We've got to stop having these conversations about people's feelings, and talk about people's lives and talk about people's communities existing for the next 30, 50, 100 years, because that's what's at stake here is who is at the most risk, who can interrupt. And that might be the issue that we talk about instead of removing the idea of blame, because that provokes feelings, right? You if you're blaming someone, you want them to feel accountable, you want them to own it. But beyond all of that, who has the best opportunity to actually affect the kind of change that is necessary? Who has the best resources to implement a strategy that helps the most people? That may be the better way to talk about this instead of blame and responsibility, even though we know there's plenty of blame to go around. And we do need those folks to acknowledge that because of luxury, because of resources, because of opportunities, there are responsibilities, not just for their citizens, not just for their neighbors, but for the planet.
Andrenika, what about issues that impact your organization or that your organization works on? You referred to them a little bit earlier. New Orleans is home to a sizable Black and Indigenous population. It is also right. The site of one of the earliest major hurricanes.
Yeah, the mother of them.
The Hurricane Katrina that really was a wake-up call to so many people That's around right. the impacts of climate change. And I imagine That's that right. those effects are still being felt.
They absolutely are. We call Katrina the mother of the modern disaster era. It ushered in the last 17 years has been crisis after catastrophe, after disaster, after pandemic, on and on and on, not just in South Louisiana, but across this country. And unfortunately, this country didn't heed the warning that Katrina offered, that Hurricane Katrina offered. The world looked to New Orleans and saw the inequity the results of government disinvestment and mismanagement of resources, as well as we're continuing to deal with the inequitable way the resources have been allocated. Communities that were seen as ground zero for Hurricane Katrina still aren't back. The people are still displaced. We are still over 100,000 people off our pre-Katrina population, which was still down 100,000, over 125,000, our all-time high, which was almost 50 years ago. So, and again, a lot of those things ushered that decline in population around white flight, the emergence of African Americans as their own political power, and then the oil and gas boom, right? People forget about that's something that hit New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina. We saw disinvestment and depopulation due to the oil and gas boom. So we've known for a while how foolish it is to rely on fossil fuels as an economic engine, but we've still not made the correction. We've not made the just transition that we need to in order to preserve our culture, to preserve our communities. And that's what New Orleans has to offer everyone, is what not to do, and a pretty darn good roadmap on what to do as well. We do have a roadmap on what to do, but mostly we are a cautionary tale on what not to do.
Thank you so much, Andrenika, for joining us today. Give out a website for your organization, the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance.
Sure, it's www.ganoha.org, GNOHA.org.
Thank you so much. We'll post a link to that from our website. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Andrenika Morris, President and Chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance, and we've been talking about the COP27 proceedings in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. Thank you. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Democrats have retained control of the United States Senate in the 2022 midterm elections, flipping one seat from red to blue. A runoff race in Georgia that could yield a re-election win for Senator Raphael Warnock would give the party 51 out of 100 seats. But Republicans are on the verge of wresting control of the House from Democrats. As of Tuesday, November 15th, the GOP has 217 seats, only one short of the 218 needed for a majority. As former President Donald Trump is expected to announce his decision to run for the 2024 presidential race, what jumps out from the midterm results is that Trump's Midas touch appears to have faded, as many of the most extreme Trump-backed candidates, including election 2020 deniers who ran for secretaries of state, lost their races. We turn to John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of the podcast Next Left, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and associate editor of The Capital Times, author of numerous books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, and Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. He's a go-to guest on our program here. Welcome back, John.
It's an honor to be with you, Sonali.
So last week, there was a lot of doom and gloom. Even on election day, there were headlines screaming that inflation was going to be the Democrats' downfall. Things turned out to be quite different. Yes, the Democrats appear to be on the verge of losing the House, but in the Senate, it was definitely a surprise. What's your assessment of why the pundits were so wrong again?
Well, because we're in incredibly volatile times. I mean, this is one of the things that we don't put into the mix quite often, and it's always a mistake. When you are in complex, difficult, challenging, unsettling, disruptive times, and certainly that's what's going on, it's hard to get a clear measure of where people are at and how they will respond to things. You have to understand, take a look at what we've been through over the last 5 or 6 years. We have, you know, had the Trump presidency, which in itself was incredibly disruptive. We've had a rejection of the Trump presidency in the 2018 election and the 2020 election. We've had the coronavirus pandemic and all the economic uncertainty associated with it. We've had inflation. We've had the Supreme Court upending a 50-year precedent on abortion rights. We have deep concerns about democracy. That's a lot of things to have churning at the same time. And I think that the mistake that a lot of pundits, and frankly, a lot of politicians make, is to assume you can go by normal patterns, right? That you put all that aside and you think, well, you know, it's a midterm election. You know, probably the party that is out of power will have major advances. Well, that wasn't the case. In fact, I think what you found on Tuesday was that a lot of people, especially young voters, were highly motivated to push back against Republican control of the House, the Senate, the state houses, because of, I think in particular, those democracy issues and the abortion rights issue.
So we have a situation now where the United States Senate is back in the Democrats' hands, or has remained rather in Democrats' hands. There's a potential on December 6th when the runoff in Georgia takes place. If Raphael Warnock wins his race, the Democrats will have a little bit more comfortable majority. But more specifically, everyone is counting on Democrats winning that race in order to neutralize the pseudo-Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who has so often held up the party's agenda in the past couple of years. Is that something that you are hoping will happen?
Well, look, I would tell you that the Georgia race is incredibly important. Yes, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars were poured into these Senate races. And you've ended up, as of right now, exactly where you started, right? You had a 50-50 split before this election. You're coming out right now with a 50-50 split. If Georgia goes to Raphael Warnock, as I think is quite likely, then Democrats move up one seat. That's not a massive advance. It's not a massive shift, but it has great significance as regards the Senate. Remember, you have two Democratic senators who have often been big problems for the Biden administration and for Democratic leadership. That's Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. If you've got one additional Democratic senator in in this case, with Raphael Warnock winning that seat, taking their number to 51, you've got a little bit of flexibility there. Obviously, if Manchin and Sinema work together, you're still stuck. You still don't have the ability to move some of the changes, make some of the things happen that you'd like. But if you can get one of those two, Manchin sometimes on economic issues, Sinema sometimes on climate and choice and other issues, you can build a workable coalition there. And so it's a subtlety, but having one more seat is actually exponentially more important than just having that additional seat. And then the final thing I will throw into the mix here is that while Republicans are likely to get the House, Democrats being in control of the Senate means that they can fill judicial vacancies. For instance, if an opening comes on the Supreme Court, they can move there. They can also fill cabinet appointments, ambassadorships, all sorts of key positions, regulatory commissions, etc. And so there's a lot of power that comes from clear control of the U.S. Senate. And so, frankly, it's a huge victory for the Democrats.
Now, let's talk about the House. Democrats had the House for 2 years and seemed to have lost it. There was a minute there, maybe late last week, when there was a slim possibility some races would go the Democrats' way. In fact, a lot of the races that the Democrats are losing are in New York and California, these big Democratic states. Perhaps these are rural areas, I think, where Democrats may not have put as much effort into campaigning. But had they maybe realized how close the fight was, things might have turned out a little bit differently for the House?
Absolutely. Let's take a couple of things and put them in perspective here. First and foremost, if the Republicans take the House, which I always thought was likely, they will do so by maybe three or four seats, could even be less than that. These close races are going to play out for quite a while. They're being called in some cases, but there will still, in many cases, there will be recounts, which are quite legitimate, reviews of the results. And so you could end up with a situation where the Republican majority is, you know, one, two, three, maybe four seats. It's probably not going to be much more than that. And so then you have to look seriously at where the loss occurred. You're right that it's New York and California. Those are key places. But I can also point to particularly rural districts in Texas, Oregon, and Wisconsin, where Democratic candidates who did not have significant support from DC Democrats, from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, from key political action committees, ended up getting incredibly strong votes, getting 48, 49% of the vote. And so in those cases, as well as some of the cases in California and New York, it's quite clear the Democrats, had they put their resources in the right places, might well have been able to retain the House. And I think they were severely weakened by a general assumption that it wasn't possible, right? There was just this sense of, well, you know, it's so overwhelming, we better save our incumbents, you know, fight hard for the races that look easily winnable. And so they put their resources there. But the problem is that in some cases they overinvested in races that they were going to win, and they underinvested, and I hate to talk about this all in money terms because there's so much more to politics, but they underinvested, especially in rural districts. And I just can't begin to tell you, Sonali, how frustrated people are out in these rural and small city areas where they've maintained the Democratic Party, where they have fought hard to maintain and keep a multiracial, multi-ethnic party. Because remember, many rural areas now have, you know, substantial indigenous population, substantial Black population, substantial Latinx population. And the Democratic Party just didn't realize its potential in some of these areas.
No.
The last thing I'll mention, oh, go ahead.
No, finish your thought.
One more race. In Western Wisconsin, in my home state, there's a district on the Mississippi River that has voted Democratic in six of the last eight presidential elections. It had a Democratic congressman until this year. And the National Democrats pulled their money out of the race because they thought that their candidate couldn't win. Well, their candidate got more than 48% of the vote. He came within a sliver of winning.
Wow.
If the resources had been there, that would have been one more seat. And if Congress comes down to one seat or two seats, you just got to look at those places and ask, you know, how did they miscalculate so badly?
John, one of the things that comes that jumps at me is that while Democrats may have miscalculated because the punditry pointed to doom and gloom, the flip side of that is that the doom and gloom scenarios did generate enough panic among voters to show up.
Yeah.
Midterm elections are historically low voter turnout elections, but we didn't see that happen. I think it wasn't as high as 2018, but we're still tallying votes. I think it might still be up in the air whether 2018 or 2022 midterms had a higher turnout, but voters panicked. People showed up. Had that punditry not been forecasting doom and gloom, maybe those voters might not have shown up. So it's really hard to sort of say how these things will turn out, right?
Well, you're a very wise analyst here because, of course, we put all of these things into the mix and there are counter polls and counter punches and all that. I know that, I was certainly among those people that thought that Democrats were going to do worse than they did. So I'm not going to claim some great, insider genius here. I thought it was going to be a tough midterm. And one of the things that made me start to rethink right toward the end of the process was that I live in Madison, Wisconsin. It's a university town. And there was a huge early vote among students. There are long lines of students. And then on election day, I remember texting with a friend because I literally took a walk. I was walking by a polling place in an area that has a lot of graduate students. And there was a line out the door and around the block.
Amazing.
And so, it's clear that whether it was fear or determination or, whatever other word we want to use to describe it, young voters especially came out in really disproportional numbers. And the interesting thing is that in the exit polling, it shows us that among voters under 30, there was a 28% advantage for the Democrats. That's almost unheard of. That's an overwhelming bias toward one party. And so I think we have to give a lot of credit to the youngest voters who, for again, whether it's fear or determination or whatever, decided to come and save the Republic.
So let's talk about what this election means for the GOP. With slim House control, the most they can do is throw up roadblocks, refuse to pass the bills that the Senate passes, but also what does the party really, do you see any honest assessment within the party on what it has cost them to throw their weight behind Trump?
Very little, to be honest. I think this is an important thing to understand. Certainly you see the pundit class, right? The folks who appear on CNN and MSNBC and even a little bit on Fox, who are saying, something went wrong here. The Republicans didn't do as well as they expected to do. And you are even seeing a handful of Republicans step up to say that. But the important thing to understand is that this is the third election cycle in which their sort of cult of personality, loyalty to Donald Trump, has cost the Republican Party dearly. It happened in 2018 when they lost a lot of ground. It happened in 2020 where they lost more ground. And it's happened in this midterm where they were supposed to make up a lot of ground, but didn't. And that's even more so in the states. And so for three cycles, Trump has been a burden to them. And yet, after the November 8th election, you saw top Republicans, people like Elise Stefanik, who's one of the top Republicans in the House, saying how Trump has to be their candidate in 2024. And so I think this is still a party that really wrestles with, what it should be and where it should go. And there are certainly some Republicans who are saying there needs to be a clear break with Trump and Trumpism. The party needs to move back toward a mainstream conservatism. But I would really strongly emphasize, I don't know that those are the dominant voices in the party even now. And one of the fantasies that plays out is a line that, maybe they'll replace Trump with DeSantis from Florida, Ron DeSantis, and somehow that will be better. The fact is that Ron DeSantis is on issue after issue after issue as extreme or more extreme than Donald Trump. So
and he's also more disciplined, which is more terrible.
He is more disciplined, and he had a big win in Florida. That's clearly to be understood. But the notion that that America is going to suddenly take a look at Ron DeSantis in places like New England or the Upper Midwest and say, "Boy, that's what we want. That's so much better than Trump." I don't necessarily think that's the case. So I don't think the deep assessment of what the Republican Party can or should be as a conservative party has really happened yet.
John, what about how progressives did on election night? In addition to the fact that that voters turned out in full force, you saw as a result of that, particularly young voters, you saw some really remarkable wins, even if they may not be part of a majority in the Democrats. You saw just in Florida, as we were talking about, the state that elected Ron DeSantis, a district elected Maxwell Frost, one of the youngest members of the party. Did progressives do well with centering a progressive platform and agenda? Did they do well on election night?
Yes, they did very well. And this is, again, one of the things that a lot of the pundit class misses, because they look at a narrow set of races and they don't pay attention actually to a lot of the broader patterns. But if you look at, for instance, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, it's going to have a lot of new young members. You mentioned Maxwell Frost, a 25-year-old who got elected from Florida. But we should also make note of Summer Lee, a new representative from Pennsylvania, of Delia Ramirez and Jonathan Jackson, both coming out of Chicago, very, very progressive figures, of Greg Kassar coming out of Austin, Texas, a very, very progressive figure, Jasmine Crockett coming out of Texas. There's, you know, the list is actually quite long. It's multiracial, multiethnic, and generally quite young. And so the Progressive Caucus is going to get an infusion of new members. I think it's also important to recognize that the Democrats who did very well in the state house races around the country, and again, there's a lot of coverage of Congress, less of the states. But if you look at who's won the governorships, Tony Evers in Wisconsin, who's a quite progressive governor, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, a quite progressive governor. These are people who got reelected.
In Arizona, there was a Democratic win. I'm not sure if it was a progressive, but that was the Democrats did better in gubernatorial elections.
Yeah, they did really well. And they did well in Secretary of State races and in state legislative races, flipping chambers. And on balance, these Democrats who ran in the states were running on a program of strong support for abortion rights, strong support for democracy, shoring up voting rights. In most cases, very strong support for unions and for organized labor. You just kind of run down the list, acknowledgement and respect for the crisis that climate change is causing. So these were not conservatives. They were, or even centrist Democrats. In many cases, you saw quite progressive Democrats winning. And of course, the capstone for it is Pennsylvania, the one Republican-held Senate seat that has flipped to a Democrat, won in Pennsylvania by John Fetterman, who ran to the left in his own primary. He had a more conservative, more centrist Democrat, Connor Lamb, running against him, and who many people in the Democratic establishment were at least a little bit afraid of. Well, John Fetterman won a pretty easy victory in Pennsylvania, despite having some severe health challenges, having had a stroke during the campaign. And how did he do it? He did it by being very, very strong in favor of labor rights, being very, very strong in favor of economic justice, supporting racial justice and supporting criminal justice reform, and being very, very strong on abortion rights, and building a campaign that didn't just focus on the big cities, but also went to every single county in Pennsylvania, even to small towns and rural areas, on the theory that there were Democrats out there, and if you just went and talked to them, they would come out and
vote. Right. So there's the battle between Democrats and Republicans. There's the battle within the Democratic Party between centrists, so-called centrists, and progressives. Just as there is a sort of analogous battle within the Republican Party, although I think that the pro-Trumpers still remain far more vocal than who they represent. But within the Democratic Party, that battle, certainly it seems as though the progressive side has won many new allies. And so we'll see how things play out in the next 2 years. And then finally, one last question, John, and you feel free to be as brief as you want to be on Trump's announcement or expected announcement to run for 2024. Journalists want to wish him away, many of us, right? But that doesn't mean he's going to go away, and avoiding talking about him doesn't mean that he's going to go away. He's still there. He's going to announce. What do you think?
Well, it does look like he's going to announce it. With Trump, you always have to be a little careful because you never know quite what he's going to do. And he can change course unexpectedly at the last moment. But I have always argued that Donald Trump was going to run for the Republican nomination in 2024 and that he was going to be the Republican nominee. Now, the Tuesday's results were not particularly good for Trump. I mean, a lot of the candidates that he put forward lost. And there is an analysis, especially among Republican strategists, of whether Trump is more of a burden than a benefit to the party. But that is not, you know, necessarily a feeling at the base of the party. And the fact of the matter is that if you know anything about Donald Trump, it is that he is a master at destroying his opponents in Republican primaries. That's what he did in 2015 and 2016 against the entire elite of the Republican Party, beating Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Scott Walker and Jeb Bush. You just run down the list of all the people that he took apart and beat. And so those who assume that Trump is finished within the Republican Party, I think make a mistake. My sense is that he's got a very good chance of taking apart Ron DeSantis. And it's clear that Trump cannot get over the fact that he lost the presidency in 2020. And so my sense is that he's gonna come back, and that's gonna be a huge burden for the Republican Party. But it is also important to remember that Donald Trump got, you know, 70 million votes in 2020. He has a following and he can get a lot of votes. And so Democrats can't just, you know, rest easy. There is still an important necessity to counter Trump and Trumpism with not just saying Trump's a bad guy, but also with a vision of economic and social and racial justice, of, you know, peace and saving the planet, something that can actually energize and excite especially young voters and disenfranchised voters. Because my sense is that we're in a period, a historical time period, where we're going to have a lot of battles. They're going to happen in election after election. Eventually, there will be a clear result. And, you know, my sense is that the arc of history bends, in the right direction. And so ultimately that clear result will be a victory for more progressive candidates, but it doesn't necessarily come easy. And so my sense is that what 2022 gives us is a sense of what's possible, but 2024 is still going to be a lot of work. And that, again, whether journalists like it or not, I suspect we'll be covering Donald Trump quite a bit.
I want to thank you so much, John, for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have you on.
It's an honor, of course, as always.
My guest has been John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation Magazine, host of the podcast Next Left, and a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, Associated Editor of The Capital Times, and a frequent guest here on our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Nearly 50,000 academic workers at 10 University of California campuses began a strike on November 14th. To bargain for better working conditions. The unionized workers are postdocs, researchers, trainees, fellows, graduate student instructors, readers, and tutors. And they're organized with UAW 5810, UAW 2865, and the newly formed SRU UAW. Although there are four separate contract fights, the UC workers are striking all together in a historic action that has already prompted calls for a mediator. Some faculty have canceled classes in solidarity. So far, there is no end date for the strike. We turn now to Joyce Chan, a postdoctoral scholar in neurosciences at UC San Diego. She's on the bargaining team with some of the workers. Welcome to the program, Joyce.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So for, you know, there've been a lot of times when strikes have been threatened and not actually played out. Occasionally a strike will go to fruition. And here we are on Monday, we saw tens of thousands of academic workers all up and down California walking out of campuses and picketing and rallying. It was quite a historic view. What led up to this moment? Can you give me a nutshell? What were the issues that prompted so many people to say, we're not going to take it anymore, we're going on strike?
Yes. So essentially what has led up to this point is that we at the bargaining table have, during many months of bargaining, made strong proposals to guarantee dignified compensation and equity in the workplace. However, progress is being thwarted by UC's unlawful conduct. And the decision to move forward with a strike, a multi-unit statewide strike, so that decision was made after months of increasing frustration at UC's refusal to come to an agreement. So the UAW members, which again consists of postdocs, graduate student, academic workers, teaching assistants, these members are struggling to make ends meet every month. And we feel like we are forced to go on strike. We can't wait around for the University of California to change course and bargain in good faith on their own timeline, right?
What is the, in terms of, you know, it often comes down to brass tacks, it comes down to money. What is the sort of the main issue that academic workers are claiming on compensation? California is a very expensive state to live in. And I noticed that a lot of those striking were pointing out things like the cost of rent, just the cost of rent, being unable to make enough to make ends meet month by month.
Right. So in terms of what we're proposing for fair compensation and also cost of living adjustments, we want a baseline salary of $54,000 a year minimum for all grad workers, in addition to $70,000 minimum for postdoc as a baseline salary. So essentially what we're currently being paid right now, it doesn't adjust for, you know, the cost of living, you know, inflation, gas prices, all the cost of living just going up, and especially trying to live in a place, as you mentioned, like California, and especially in San Diego, with the skyrocketing prices of properties and rent, it's really hard to be able to make it day by day. And essentially what the UC is proposing in terms of like 3%, 7%, like small percent increases in salary, each like annual salary, essentially that results in a net loss to us. So we would be losing money if we were to continue with the UC's proposals.
Right, because inflation is going up much faster than those paltry increases.
Yeah, the increases that the university is proposing can't catch up, right, with that inflation cost of living. So we, like, our proposals are not only realistic, but we feel that they are necessary, since for a lot of our academic workers, 30 to 80% of our income goes towards making rent alone.
Let's talk about the fact that the University of California system is supposed to be a state, it is a state university system. It's supposed to be one that, you know, is affordable for students. And it's also supposed to be one that has a solid reputation academically. And we often hear that the reason why grad students or postdocs or even adjunct professors, although they're not part of this fight, are paid so little is because they would have to pass those costs down to students. What's wrong with that logic?
So what's wrong with that logic is that we know that our working conditions are our students' learning conditions, right? So if our graduate students, if our teaching assistants, lecturers are all paid well and don't have to struggle to teach classes or to mentor students, or, you know, if our postdoctoral researchers, our scientists are not, you know, going hungry or unable to make ends meet in terms of rent, we improve the quality of our science, we improve the quality of our teaching, our research, etc. And the quality of the education we are able to provide currently is being compromised because, you know, of the hardship that we are trying to survive on our current contract. So if the UC meets our demands for fair compensation, they would be far more able to focus on the teaching, on the research, on everything that makes the University of California great. So we believe that a temporary disruption to our students' education and research is worth a long-term improvement to everyone's experience at the UC. And also, like, not every teaching moment happens in a classroom. Like, sometimes you have to stand up for yourself. And additionally, our students, our colleagues in the lab are with us, including some faculty members, and they understand what it means when you're being untreated fairly, and that this is our opportunity to speak up.
Does the UC system have the money to meet the financial demands of the unions?
So we believe so, because as California's biggest employer, the UC has a $46 billion annual budget. And it also has resources to ensure that our academic workers who do the bulk of the teaching and research are fairly compensated. So in terms of our compensation proposals, the proposals for graduate workers would end up being less than 3% of the UC's budget. And honestly, it's more reasonable to spend about 3% for the bulk of all the teaching and research labor, right?
Wow.
And also, the research budget and funding from the state into the UCs continues to hit record levels. Yet, you know, the University of California is not offering compensation that matches our contributions to its research and its teaching missions and its commitment to equity and a diverse workplace.
So Joyce, the state has a budget surplus as well. I mean, there is money if the UC system, claimed it needed more. There is money around. California's economy is booming. It just surpassed the entire economy of Germany. And yet these are workers who are paid just not very much. And give me also a sense of, you're a postdoc in neurosciences. Give me a sense of the contribution that academic workers like yourself make to society. I mean, we shouldn't have to say it, spell it out, because it seems obvious, but let's go ahead and do that. I mean, you're talking about folks who work in the sciences, who work in the liberal arts, in humanities, and in history, and, these are folks who are contributing to society and educating another generation of folks who will then take their place. This is a very significant work that's being done, right?
So when people think of the UCs, they think of a very top-tier research and just top-tier place for research and learning, right? So our students, in the sciences, they go on to become doctors, they go on to become engineers, that influence, that contribute to, infrastructure and also medicine, finding cure for diseases, understanding how the brain works even. Like, I think it can't be understated, like, how important the university's research is in social mobility, in improving people's futures, right? And also in the arts as well, just creating work that moves people. And especially in this age of disinformation, history education is more needed than ever. And I can honestly go on and on about it. But
what about the
again, I'll
yes,
sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And additionally, like, all the work that the postdocs, the graduate students do, they bring in grants, they bring in funding, they bring in life to university, and the university continues to, like, for postdoc, I could talk about postdoc especially, postdocs have earned their PhDs. We specialize in specific topic. And yet for some of the language that we hear at the bargaining table in other places, they refer to us as trainees, as if we're new to this field or don't have experience, which again, some of us might be switching paths or finding a new place to apply our research. But we're still highly qualified individuals who have, invested 5, sometimes 4 to 6 years of our life on a topic. And, we should also be respected as such. Right?
Do you see the emboldened demands from UC academic workers as part of also a new moment in labor organizing nationwide. You know, there are unemployment is low. If you sort of use the wonkish speech of the mainstream economists, we are in a tight labor market, which of course gives workers more leverage. And the pandemic also was a wake up call for many workers around the United States about just how badly, you know, this sort of realization of how badly they're being treated, the indignity of low-paid hard work. Can you put into the national labor context this UC academic strike?
So for a lot of the academic workers at the UC, we see this pattern of indignity and, you know, unfair wages, unfair contracts as a sort of universal theme, you know, not only in the States, but also worldwide. And also we've been very inspired by a lot of what's been happening, especially with Starbucks, like even hearing that academic workers in Colombia, you know, were on strike, you know, right. That, you know, we're not just, like graduate students are not just students, we're also employees, and that we have the right to demand better pay and better working conditions, and also for to be able to demand things and be heard, right? To address the precise problems that we have in academia, because similar to other, you know, very specialized fields, there's a leaky pipeline for women in science and academia. There's a leaky pipeline for parents, for first generation academics. Like, it could go on and on. I could go on and on about this. Right.
Joyce, there is right now no plan to end the strike. I mean, generally, when unionized workers go on strike, it's because negotiations have failed. They've been at the bargaining table. They haven't been able to make headway. And so then the next and the most extreme step is a strike. And generally, strikes end when the other side concedes to demands. Can you give me a sense of what you expect to happen? You know, strikes sometimes can be completely open-ended. They could end the next day. They could continue for months. You never know.
Yeah, it's true. The strikes are open-ended. And for us, we do not have a set end date for the strike, but the university can at any point remedy their unfair labor practices and start to bargain in good faith. And we hope that they do that soon, right? And over 36,000 workers who voted yes on the strike authorization vote, it sends a strong message to the UC that we're united and we're ready to hold them accountable. And again, we hope that this will compel them to bargain sooner in good faith. But again, if that doesn't happen soon, we'll have to continue our strike. We'll have to continue withholding our labor, which again means withholding teaching of classes, of withholding our research. Again, things that keep the university running, right?
Well, how can people express solidarity with the work, with the strikers? And I imagine that some faculty and students, undergrads, are potentially doing so.
So already we do have some faculty that signed a letter or sent letters to university administration. I know that the Council of UC Faculty Associations, CUCFA, they did submit a letter and also wrote a very nice FAQ about how to support the striking academic workers.
And is there a website you can give out for more information?
So one of the websites is faircnow.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later today. Joyce, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck to you and your fellow workers.
Yes, thank you so much for having me today.
My guest has been Joyce Chan, a postdoctoral fellow postdoctoral scholar in neurosciences at the University of California, San Diego, and one of the union organizers at a historic UC academic workers strike. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Kitsap.
Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow.